Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest bonus episode for The Rest is History. We meet in very exciting circumstances because Tom has literally just arrived in his house.
I have. I've just arrived from Gatwick.
From a Scandinavian odyssey. And with perfect timing, Tom, we'll get into your Scandinavian odyssey in a second. But the latest edition of History Today, formerly edited by Rest is History alumnus Paul Lay, but no longer. Paul Lay would never have countenanced a story like this. So the story is, the headline says, "Goodbye to the Vikings. The term Viking, as it is commonly used, is misleading, warping our perception of the Middle Ages. It should be retired," says Alex Wolf. Well, Alex, good luck with that, with trying to cancel the uses of the word Viking. Tom, what do you make of all this? Do you think we should no longer call them the Vikings?
Well, it's very analogous to the debate over what should we call the inhabitants of early medieval lowland Britain, Anglo-Saxons.
Or as normal people not, called them, the Anglo-Saxons.
What else should we call them? I mean, essentially, the word Viking is inadequate to cope with the complexity of all the various peoples and cultures and civilizations and time periods that they cover, but there isn't really anything else. And essentially, it's about kind of convenience. Historians have been grumbling about this forever. And every so often, somebody will say we need to retire the word Viking because it's inaccurate. And then everybody else just says, yeah, but what are we going to replace it with?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's madness, isn't it? So every book about the Vikings you ever read, I mean, I've just written a children's book about the Vikings, so I've been deep into the Vikings. So basically every single book, Tom, all the books on the Vikings, they have this little bit in the preface that says they didn't call themselves the Vikings and, you know, blah, blah, blah. To go Viking was this, that, and the other. It just means to be a raider, blah, 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 blah.
And it's Walter Scott, basically, again, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Walter Scott always, I mean, he's always behind all this.
He's always inventing things. He's inventing Robin Hood, he's inventing Vikings.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a complete waste of time because children do them at school, not just in Britain, but they do them, you know, across Europe, don't they, the Vikings? And everyone knows what a Viking is, horned helmets, long ships.
Yeah.
And there's just no point in fighting. It's like saying, let's get rid of the term the Renaissance or the Enlightenment or any of these things.
I mean, I think it reflects, in a way, the closer, the more specialized you become in a period, the more conscious you become that the historical conveniences, so whether it's in terms of area or in chronology, are inadequate to cope with the complexity of the situation. I mean, that's essentially
true.
It.
But at some point, you have to say something, Tom.
Exactly, exactly. And I think it's interesting that one of the things that drove the adoption of the word Viking in the 19th century was the emergence of museums, of national museums. So it's in Scandinavia that they developed the idea of Stone Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age.
Is that so?
Yeah.
It's invented in Scandinavia.
Yeah, because the implements that are coming out of the ground in Scandinavia are defined basically by what they're made of.
Yeah.
So they don't really have the written sources. And the Viking Age is essentially, it's what you might call the late prehistoric age in Scandinavia or the late Iron Age. But it intersects with periods of history that in other reaches of Europe are not prehistoric. As I said, I just got in from the airport, so I haven't really had time to look at the questions, but I did see this question because it's the first one on the sheet that we got sent. And it reminded me of...
It's from Dreadnought, by the way, we should say who it's from.
Dreadnought. It reminded me of a wonderful sentence, one of my favorite sentences ever written about the Vikings, in a book by Erik Christensen, The Norseman in the Viking Age. Did you come across that one?
I don't think I did. It's quite old, isn't it?
Written about 20 years ago. And he says, and unfortunately, he kicks off by talking about, is the word Viking adequate? If it isn't, then what else can we talk about? And the complexity of how much chronological slicing and dicing there is in the what we might call the Viking period. And he says that an unfortunate traveler sailing from Bremen to Novgorod shortly after the year 1100 would pass from the Salian period to the early medieval to the late Viking to the crusading to the Viking again to the Kievan.
Oh, that's very good. Yeah.
Does it matter? It wouldn't if names attached to periods and ages were not taken to be settled verdicts on the nature of those times. And I think that's the key, that Viking, like Anglo-Saxon, is a convenience because the study of the past isn't just for academic specialists.
It
has to be accessible to broad range of people who are interested in history.
Yeah.
And that includes, you know, primary school children.
I mean, it's that classic thing, isn't it, Tom? When you're at university and people sort of say, I mean, you must have had this when you did English. when the sort of classic essay question, you know, does it make any sense to talk of romanticism? And ultimately, the answer is always yes, because we have to be able to talk about things.
Yeah.
So it's just a pointless.
Yeah. And if you didn't have convenient phrases like that, how would historians get, you know, what would they write about in
exactly
history?
What would they
today?
Send angry tweets about? Yes. All right. So listen, you have been on an odyssey, haven't you? You're like Odysseus returning to Ithaca.
Well, a Norse epic, I would say.
Yeah, a Norse epic. You're like the fellow in that, and Franz Bengtsson's The Long Ships.
Yeah.
If you've read that. So you've been on this great odyssey. You haven't been to Al-Andalus or indeed to Kyiv or to Constantinople, but you have been to an airport hotel in Oslo, which is very exciting. And more interestingly, perhaps for our listeners, you've been to Roskilde, which is the great Viking ship museum. So you give me a lecture at Roskilde, Tom.
So it was a conference that I got invited to 2 years ago and then completely forgot about.
Right, all pandemic commitments, you thought it would never happen.
Yes, yes. And then I suddenly realised, oh God, I've got to go to Roskilde. So I went off and did, it was Dominion themed. So I gave three talks on Dominion related themes, got worked very hard, but did have time to see the Roskilde Ship Museum, which I actually saw 10 years ago when we went on a family holiday to Copenhagen.
Yeah.
But the girls were that much younger then and possibly even less interested in ships then than they are now. So my memory of it wasn't great, but it's, have you been there?
I have, yes.
I find ships quite boring.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's good to see them, but
yeah.
I'm not that bothered about the straking of timbers or the sort of, you know, the your brother is that there must be lots of your brother's equivalent who are interested in the Viking Age and are terribly interested in navigational mechanisms.
Yes, and how sails are made. And
yeah,
things like that.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So even with the girls, I think I did it in 5 minutes. And I think even just with me, I did it in about 10 minutes. But I was very happy to see it.
It's an odd thing, isn't it? Because we took Arthur when he was much younger. And probably like your girls, he was really only interested in Viking museums where you could dress up as a Viking.
They have excellent, actually, they have excellent dress-up facilities.
Yeah, most of them do in Scandinavia, don't they? They have a little area where you can play Tafl, the board game, and you can put on a sort of fur.
Helmet.
And helmet. And the kids generally enjoy that. But when you say, come and look at these fascinating flints.
Yes. Look at the way that the timbers are...
Yeah,
and
of course, with all Viking museums now, there's always the sort of mandatory sections on multicultural exchange with lots of pictures of kind of brooches and discussions of interesting designs. And
they didn't really have that.
Shifting
actually.
Identities and
to
stuff.
To be fair to the Roskilde Viking Ship Museum, it was
they're
all
holding
about,
out.
It was all
it's
about
any matter
planks.
Of time.
It was all about it's all about the planks and the joining. But then I went to the cathedral, Roskilde Cathedral.
I've been there. Very good.
Okay, so likewise, that was also slightly hamstrung by having girls who weren't particularly interested in the tombs of Danish monarchs.
Yeah.
But it's sensational. So this time I did it really properly, 2 hours. I don't know if you remember, there's an excellent medieval clock.
Yes, I saw we were there when they did the figures all came out.
So it's George and the Dragon.
Yeah.
So George and the Dragon, and on the hour, the dragon screams. And I read this in the guide and thought, well, I want to hear that. And it's a proper scream. He kind of goes, ah!
I don't remember that.
And then it goes, dong, dong, dong. Excellent. And there was, all the tombs of the various kings, including friend of the show, Harold Bluetooth, supposedly, although no one knows exactly where it is, but it was good to see him have a mention. He built the first church on the site. And I think the most exciting thing was, which I'd missed the last time I went, behind the altar, there is a whole series of tombs. And one of them is just a long, black, very shiny stone. And this supposedly is the burial ground of a three-legged horse with eyes like burning coal. Wow. And every so often it comes up out of the grave. And if you see it, it's not good news.
For you?
No, for the person who sees it.
Wow, that's exciting.
Did you?
I didn't see it.
And you didn't see it?
I didn't see. Did I see the tomb? I mean, I might have done. To be honest, I'm quite a poor tourist of churches and cathedrals. So Rachel Morley, if she was here, would absolutely be lambasting me.
I loved it. I sucked the juice out of the orange quarter that was Roskilde Cathedral.
I think you have to go on your own, though, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
To really get the most out of these things. Because if you're with, you know, a wife.
I'm bored.
Or children. Yeah.
Oh, not another tomb.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Are you traveling with people with sort of children's voices from the 1970s, Tom, by your impersonation?
I don't like this tomb. That's a creepy boy.
We need to press on. Claire J.
Can I read it out?
Yeah, you read it out.
It's like dropping sugar on a cow pat. Have you ever done that?
No.
Oddly. You drop sugar on a cow pat and it supposedly it explodes.
I don't believe that's
so
true.
So this message is the sugar and you, Dominic, are the cow pat.
Thank you. That's nice.
I listened this morning to the sister podcast, The Rest Is Politics, and I heard both Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell recommend the New York Times to its listeners. Rory Stewart because of its international news and Alistair Campbell because of its British news. And they were reading it in preference to the British press.
Absolute idiocy.
However, if I remember correctly, Dominic dislikes the New York Times, and I'm not sure Tom likes it either. So who is right, or why the difference in views? Do we need a joint podcast to thrash it out? So Dominic, do you like the New York Times?
No, I don't. How long have we got? I mean,
cowpat explodes.
How long do we have? So I've read a ton of editions of the New York Times because the New York Times was in some ways the kind of backbone of my PhD. So the New York Times and the Washington Post, I basically went through it on microfilm, on old-fashioned microfilm machines, because my PhD was about American politics in the sort of 50s and 60s. So the New York Times historically was just unbelievably boring. It was an unbelievably boring, badly presented newspaper by the standards of international newspapers. Stories weirdly chopped up and put on, you know, half of it's on one page and then it says turn to A17 for the rest of the story, you know, that kind of thing they do. But just incredibly boring and lifeless and pompous. And then about 10 years ago, American listeners will know better than me, they dropped some of the boringness and pomposity by becoming incredibly kind of, I guess they became much more partisan.
Very self-righteous.
Very self-righteous. Now, that's all fine. Newspapers have their own identity. But what I really dislike about it is no other newspaper, I think, has such an air of sanctimony as the New York Times. So the Guardian kind of knows it's being the Guardian, if you know what I mean. You know, it knows that it is party-pre, as all British newspapers do. The New York Times, you know, they'll publish the most colossal stories about their own ethics, won't they? They're so introverted and they have all these internal debates and they take themselves so unfeasibly seriously. But also, their reporting, in particular Britain, is laughable. I mean, the idea that Alistair Campbell would recommend it because it's British news is just absolutely risible. Because they run stories about how in Britain people eat gruel.
No,
and they
it's
live
mutton.
In,
mutton live in, and porridge.
Wasn't there something about us living in our swamps and swamplands?
No, that was Russia.
No.
I mean, hard to tell them
no,
apart.
No, I've seen that in the New York Times.
The famous one is that there was some article about the British restaurant scene saying that London restaurants have now moved on from the traditional, the mutton that people until last year were all eating in restaurants. I've never had mutton.
Yeah, mutton and jellied eels.
No, they didn't even mention jellied eels. I mean, jellied eels, at least there'd be a kind of Dick Van Dyke chimney sweep kind of element of authenticity to it. But mutton, I mean, no one's eaten mutton forever. But also, I love the real estate language that American newspapers use, very distinctive to America. And the New York Times ran a feature on London's upmarket Brixton Hill area.
Oh, God almighty.
And I knew because I live on Brixton Hill.
Yeah, that they'd never been to Brixton.
No, they'd never been to it. They'd made it all up. Because they very much didn't describe the upmarket Arizona chicken restaurant, which is basically the quality of the establishments on Brixton Hill at the time they wrote it.
But are they not, am I not right in saying, Tom, that the New York Times, perhaps not unlike Alistair Campbell, is one of those publications that has been driven mad by Brexit?
Well, yes, because, and this is basically, I think the New York Times has been a victim of Brexit because the guy who became the kind of head honcho there was the former director general of the BBC. Not the director general. Yes, he was the director general, Mark Thompson.
Yeah.
So I think that he very much saw Trump through the eyes of Brexit.
And vice versa.
And I think, yes, and I think also that kind of fed into, the kind of solipsism that comes naturally to national newspapers, which is always to see foreign affairs through the prism of your own politics. But I think that's particularly the case with America, because America is, of course, you know, I mean, it's the superpower, so it can afford to do that.
Yeah.
And so everything Brexit-related was seen through the eyes of Trump. And so over the course of Trump's period in office, everything in Britain had to be cast as absolutely monstrous and appalling, which I guess is why Alistair Campbell would have enjoyed it.
Exactly. I used to read its stories, its coverage of British affairs, and I used to think, this is written by somebody who's never been to Britain, who has absolutely no concept of what things are happening in Britain.
Well, I think it's a very, it seems to have become quite colonial. Its attitude to British affairs is absolutely seen through the prism of American politics, American perspectives.
Yeah, agreed.
And I think that doesn't make for good.
Agreed completely.
You know, I hesitate to disagree with Rory Stewart, hesitate to disagree with him, but I think their international news, certainly the British news, is terrible.
Dire. Okay, great. Anyway, well, I'm glad we agree on that. And I'm glad we've secured the New York Times. So there's now a discussion, Tom, which is an interesting one, about the creation of new cities for the Jubilee. So people have been talking about this on the Discord. Colchester is a city. Stanley in the Falklands is a city. Bangor is a city. And so on and so forth. Dunfermline has become a city, the burial place of the Scottish kings. There's been a lot of chat about it. People are saying, what's going on? What's all this? Mary Kirk Alves asks the crucial question, you know, who cares? How meaningful is all this? What's your take on all this?
I have no idea. I know nothing. I don't know the answer to Mary.
Well, I think
Mary's question.
If top expert Tom Holland doesn't know, nobody knows. But I don't know either. I think it's completely meaningless.
It's some kind of Jubilee flummery, isn't it?
It is. It's making people feel good about themselves. It's also
David Amos, the MP who got killed, who murdered
Southend-on-Sea,
was always this was his shtick. He would show his enthusiasm for Southend by endlessly going on about how Southend should be a city. And so as a mark of respect to him when he was murdered, they made Southend a city, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, I would say too many places are cities. I would also say it's an Americanization again, Tom, because in America, of course, very small places can call themselves cities and often do. And I think, you know, what places that we would consider suburbs of other places call themselves cities. I think we're slightly copying that, and there's this sort of sort of inflation of titles where you're the executive vice president for cleaning the toilets or something.
Okay, so my opinion on cities, for what it's worth, and it's not something I've ever really thought deeply about, but a city has to have a cathedral.
I could not agree more.
So that's my definition.
Yes.
So Salisbury, absolutely.
City.
Absolutely.
St. David's
city.
Is a city.
St. David's, a city. I also think that civitatis capitals in Roman Britain. So these were settlements that were established as kind of Roman versions of the tribal centres that had existed before the Roman occupation. I think they should be cities. So I'm astounded that Colchester wasn't a city because that was established as the first capital of Roman Britain.
Deep down, I don't think any place that wasn't a city before I was born should now be a city.
Yeah, unless they've built a cathedral since you were born.
Wolverhampton was created a city for the millennium, but I don't ultimately think it should be.
But Coventry,
yeah,
absolutely.
Cathedral.
Yeah. Yeah. But don't you agree that Colchester, I mean, I think Silchester should be a city, even though there's, you know, it's basically just a ruin.
Would Cirencester be a city?
Yes.
See, I've been to Cirencester. It's very nice. It's got a fantastic church, but it's not a cathedral.
Yeah, but it was a Roman settlement, so I think it should. I might draw the line at Vindolanda. But that was a fort rather than a native
Roxeter outside Shrewsbury, Viriconium. Should that be a city?
Yeah.
I mean, that's barely even a village.
I mean, so you become an extra city if you're both.
Okay.
So London, definitely. Yeah. Gloucester, definitely.
Bath. Bath has an abbey, but not a cathedral.
Yes, but it was a very significant Roman centre and it was used for the coronation of Edgar the Peaceable.
Okay.
I think if you've hosted a coronation,
yeah,
that makes you a city. So Kingston on Thames.
I think we should bring back the word Burr, like Alfred the Great's Burrs.
Yes, absolutely.
It should be more of an acknowledgement of that.
Yes,
I think Burrs should be obliged to rebuild their walls and also provide the men to guard them.
Yeah, I think, and also if you were founded by Athelflaed or Edward the Elder.
So we've put that one to bed, I think, very successfully.
Yeah, that out.
Philip, I don't know if this is a typo from Sam, if it's Felix Rex or Philip Rex. Either way, whoever he is, he was delighted by the Athelstan's meetup.
Yeah, we enjoyed that.
Have we not done a bonus since then, Tom? I don't think we have.
No, we haven't, because we did the episode on the Queen, didn't we?
So the Athelstan's meetup was obviously, for those people who don't know, it was for our Athelstan members. We met at the Green Man in Fitzrovia. I met up with my sister-in-law, Rachel Morley, a friend of the show beforehand. And as we walked towards the pub, I had this sort of this sinking feeling, you know, that I'd get to the pub and there would be you and the producers. And there'd be sort of maybe two people you know, standing there nervously, and it would just be a bit of a shambolic.
But it was heaving, wasn't it?
It was heaving. It was absolutely heaving. And I really enjoyed it. You were exhausted, Tom, by the end of it, weren't you?
Well, I'd been there longer than you. And I,
about 10 minutes longer.
I think I'd drunk too much, to be honest.
Right. But it was the pressure of meeting all your adoring fans, wasn't it?
No, it was the pressure of watching you surrounded by your adoring fans.
Ah, that's rubbish.
Every so often I'd look over and you'd be holding forth, surrounded by...
By men of a certain age.
It was a very upsetting experience.
It was very good fun, actually. I tell you what was really nice was that everybody seemed to mix really well and get on really well. Because obviously it's an unusual party in that people are all going kind of individually. Yeah. Nobody knows anybody.
And absolute kudos to the people who'd come insane distances.
Sheila from Seattle. Somebody from Toronto, somebody from Myanmar.
And from Ireland.
Yes. Killian from Ireland.
And now what was his name? Who hadn't come all the way from Siberia because he works in London.
That's right.
But was from Siberia.
That's right. He does work in London. Yeah. There were some people who'd come from the Europa League final. some Scotsman.
That's right. Yes. Drowning their sorrows. Yes.
It was really, really good fun. And then we did your charity event 2 days later. So we were real gluttons for punishment that week.
Yes. Which I thought was a wonderful occasion. And thank you very much for doing that.
It was fun. It was really good
fun. And we raised 50,000.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Sensational.
And you had a great lineup of guests. So I think there were only a couple of people who hadn't been on the show. Because we had Michael Wood. We've never had Sebastian Fulks on the show.
Yeah, so we hadn't had Sebastian. We hadn't had Susie Maidment, who is a dinosaur specialist.
But we've had Dan Snow was there. And a very
Rutherford
impressive,
also.
Very impressive linen suit, I have to say, Dan Snow was wearing.
Yeah.
He was very well turned out. Anyway, people don't subscribe to this podcast to listen to our fashion tips about Dan Snow's wardrobe. they come for things like this. Amy Mantravadi has asked a question about who was the most boring British monarch of all time. So this is during the live stream episode, which was about Elizabeth II, which was slightly marred at the beginning by technical flaws, but we got there eventually. Some people said William IV. Some people said George V. I don't think either of those people are boring.
George V is interesting because he's boring, isn't he? I mean,
being
boring is
his shtick. His boringness is the point and the age of the dictators.
A bit like the Queen today.
Yeah.
I mean, the Queen's quite boring.
I'm going to be brutally honest. I find the Queen very boring.
Yeah, I think she is boring, but in a way that, I mean, we've said this because we've been doing nothing except talk about the Queen. But she is very boring.
At least George has his stamps and also the murder of his Romanov cousins and stuff.
Yeah, and the son, Prince John.
That's right, Prince John. There's Stephen Polyakov drama about that. Very good drama.
I find George I quite boring. I don't really
his
know.
His Germanness is quite interesting, though.
I don't really know anything about him.
And right.
I don't feel any great desire to know anything about him.
What about Henry III? He would be my suggestion.
No. He presides over the castration of Simon de Montfort's corpse.
Okay.
I think that's interesting.
I suppose that is quite interesting. What about...
He's king when London gets firebombed by burning cockerels.
That's such a common formula, isn't it? Did that happen?
It certainly didn't happen in the time of George
I. I'll tell you who's boring, even though in a weird way her life is quite interesting. So William III's wife, Mary, who is also a monarch in her own right, obviously.
Yeah, she's quite boring, isn't she?
But what does anyone know about her other than the fact that she basically, kicked her own father out and became queen? That's quite interesting.
That's more than the Queen's done, isn't it?
Yeah, it is more than the Queen's
done. I think the Queen is the most boring.
Okay. Harsh, but I think I don't necessarily massively disagree with it. Okay, let's move on because we can get bogged down. I can see the stuff on that Sam has created about T-shirts with your face on, but we don't need to talk about that. let's talk about Agatha Christie because we've never actually really got into.
Okay, and I think Relax Okay cuts to the chase here with the big revelation of that episode. And actually, there were quite a lot of revelations because I basically gave away the plot of all the most of
that was
key.
Fair though, because we had a spoiler warning at the beginning.
I know we did. Okay, but I mean, this was the real bombshell. Yeah. Dominic Sandbrook's Pleasure Island is a phrase that will never leave my head. I'm picturing it as one of Alan Partridge's ideas pitched for a BBC show.
Yeah.
So Dominic Sandbrook's Pleasure Island, you revealed that this was the name that the BBC wanted to give your series on Britain as the kind of the birthplace of all these internationally accepted popular formulae.
Yeah, an absolutely ridiculous title. It was that or For Your Pleasure. An absolutely laughable title. And the BBC do this weird thing. I mean, I no longer have to worry about going to these awful meetings in kind of broadcasting house where there'd be 20 people who all look exactly the same with terrible glasses. And
W1A.
Yeah, and I wouldn't know who any of them were. And they'd all be telling me about their brilliant, their ideas for Balderdash.
People carrying in their portable bikes.
I'm so glad that I don't have to do that anymore. But this is a very good example because they would sort of say, I remember saying at one point, could I decide what the series? Could I at least have a say? And the idea of this was so outlandish that
yes,
I might.
Good. No, right. Yes. Okay. Let's move on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm glad that that's, but that really was the title they wanted to go with. Pleasure Island. Dominic.
Well, it's a great shame that they didn't, but we can.
I like to think that this show in itself, Tom, is a Pleasure Island of mine.
It is. And it would be nice to have an episode called Pleasure Island. And I think somebody suggested that we do the top 10 Pleasure Islands.
Yeah, I suggested that. I suggested.
Okay, so it was you. That's an excellent idea.
Tiberias on Capri.
Tiberias on Capri is the obvious one. Yeah. I guess we could have Circe.
Mythical
Pleasure Islands.
Napoleon's Pleasure Island.
We could have Sinbad, I suppose.
Elba, St. Helena.
I think we should do that.
I think that's it. That would be very
interesting. And on the topic of mysterious islands where things happen, back to Agatha Christie.
Yeah.
So Sarah Carey, journalist, of course.
Yeah, Irish journalist.
I'm just a few minutes in, but have to register outrage at Ruth Rendell sneering at Christie. I read a few of her books recently, and the snobbery and classism is unreal. And her books are set much later, but her cops despise the lower orders, and she's super nasty about women's appearance and clothes. Christie had wit and was sympathetic to women.
It's interesting. Do people still read Ruth Rendell? Are her books still in print?
I'm a great fan of Ruth Rendell.
Are you?
Yes. She includes some glowing references to some contemporary historians.
That is very funny. There's some guy who does
so it name checks Rubicon a couple of times.
It's weird how they do it because there's some guy who does that with me, and I'm trying to remember. It might be a writer called Peter James, or it might be somebody else. But anyway, somebody put me onto it, and they said, "Look at this book, page 258," and it's exactly the detective goes home, and it says, "He picked up Dominic Sambrook's Never Had It So Good."
Yes.
A really interesting evocation of life. It was a really weird kind of insertion. Yeah.
Well, so the passage that I was sent and which I always treasure said he thought he might curl up with some Roman history, either Gibbon or Holland.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's
great. So thanks very much, Sarah, for
So Ruth Rendell is up there with Prince Edward.
Yes. Absolutely.
That's your Pleasure Island, right? You get there and it's Ruth Rendell and Prince Edward.
Yes, I mean, imagine.
Okay, so Niall Kay talks about the backstory of Poirot.
Such as there is, which is interesting. So essentially there isn't a backstory.
Yeah. And Lurkio says he thinks backstory is overrated. Do you know, I think Lurkio might be right because, of course, the obsession with backstories is rather like that thing that Disney are doing right now with, let's say, Star Wars or Marvel, where they're trying to fill in every conceivable gap. And, of course, Amazon are doing that with The Lord of the Rings, as we'll discuss later in the year when we do our Tolkien podcasts. This sort of, I must know everything that made this character who he or she is. And the idea that Poirot is more interesting if you give him a dark backstory.
There is a case, isn't there, to say that the first person really to do that is Conan Doyle. And he has problems with it. Because obviously he didn't construct a kind of biography of Sherlock Holmes from the beginning. And it's all just kind of bits and pieces all over the place. And he keeps forgetting.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
How Watson met Holmes and all this kind of stuff. And who's married to who and when. Yeah. And all this kind of
Watson's
thing.
Watson's wife's name changed from time
that's
to
right.
time.
Yeah. And so there are kind of attempts to write Holmes's biography where there's a lot of kind of juggling and slicing and dicing having to go on. So, I think that is a problem.
I think the mystery is often the appeal. The things that are unknown, I mean, it's obviously the classic thing with Tolkien. There's so much that's unknown in the story, so fans are able to fill it in themselves. Yeah. Once you eliminate all that. So J.K. Rowling is doing that at the moment with her Harry Potter world, isn't she? She's filling in all the...
Yeah, and kind of looking forward, isn't she, as well, to when Harry Potter has grown up and become a tax inspector or something, isn't that
right? Yeah, exactly. I don't think he's a tax inspector.
He's something very boring. But I suppose actually the ultimate kind of example of that is mythology.
Yeah.
Mythology, in a way, is a kind of endless attempt at working out backstories of much-loved characters. And they often tend to be incredibly contradictory. So all the attempts to kind of fill in the gaps that Homer left.
Yeah. And whenever you buy a book about, you know, a book about the Greek myths or a book about the Norse myths, those books in themselves, the, I don't know, Kevin Crossley Holland on the Norse myths, which is a brilliant book, by the way, they are an attempt to impose a sort of an order where none exists in reality because the stories all contradict themselves. And indeed, with the Norse myths,
yeah,
the Norse myths are all written down hundreds of years later anyway, aren't they? So
in a Christian period. So they're simply Christianized.
Yeah, like the story of Ragnarok or whatever. Anyway, let's move on.
Sandler Burgundian Wang, Agatha Christie, English or British? I bet my overcooked beef on English, despite her penchant for Egypt and Orient Express voyages, or was she subtly mocking the little England's broad? I would say she is English, but English at a time where England was equated with Britain by the English, would be my answer.
She would not have understood the division or the people. I mean, most people, certainly in England, would not have understood the question, actually, Jane, I would say. She's of a generation that really do think themselves to be completely British, isn't she, Tom?
Yeah, but England and Britain are kind of muddled.
So let's move on to the new Elizabethans. So this was their much-loved Sotheby's podcast, I think, wasn't it? Where you did your excellent punk laugh, which I think was the highlight of the episode.
And had my my mention of Prince Andrew ruthlessly.
Well, let's start with that. Aurelius says, your question about whether Francis Christie and Sotheby's had stuff about Prince Andrew,
yes,
he wishes that could be included in the bonus episode. So basically, for those people who don't know, we did the podcast. Sotheby's were very keen for us to do it. We did a podcast with them where Francis Christie, who was a very good sport, I have to say, came on. She was the sort of vice boss of Sotheby's, in charge of their modern stuff. She came on with a series of artifacts, which weren't necessarily to our taste, Tom. I think we can say that we're not great fans of the history of tiaras, but there was a tiara, there was an Andy Warhol, there was all this sort of stuff. And you asked her at the end, do you have a lot of memorabilia about Prince Andrew in your exhibition? And this was in the context of the tiara discussion. She did an absolutely brilliant bit of, I thought, sort of very politician style, she said.
Yes.
She just ignored the fact that you'd asked the question, just said, well, the fascinating thing about, so we've got so many tiaras, and you know, you were determined to get her to talk about Prince Andrew.
Well, I wasn't. I immediately sensed that this was not something that she wanted to talk about. And indeed, it turned out afterwards that apparently there had been a provision that we weren't allowed to mention Prince Andrew, which I hadn't realized. So that's why he wasn't mentioned.
What would you have for an exhibition on Prince Andrew, Tom? What would you have?
I'd have that photo. But they can't find it, can they?
Which photo?
The photo of him holding, what's her name?
Oh, right, yeah, okay. Would you have something from the menu of the Pizza Express at Woking?
Yeah, something like that. I think there'd be quite a lot of scope for...
I'd have a copy of Sarah Ferguson's book, Budgie, children's books.
Yes. And her Weight Watchers adverts. So, there's quite a lot of... there's a documentary trail there. Maybe a photo of his South Fork, South York, wasn't it? It was called. It was his and Fergie's Dallas-style house that they built.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure to his...
I think there'd be all kinds of things that they
could... If you wanted to show more nuanced view of Prince Andrew, you would show stuff from the Falklands, Tom.
Yes. His sweaty jumpsuit.
Right. Who Stark? You have this stuff about Kustark in there, some pinups.
Indeed, yes.
Oh, I mean, that's actually a great exhibition. Right, let's have some other questions. So Alistair has a more serious question. He's only just joined the Discord to specifically ask this question. He says, Prince Charles has spent his life waiting for his mother, the Queen of Longevity, to move on and give him a shot at the top job. Would he not pass when the time comes so as not to do the same to his son? And I think the answer to that is no. I mean, he will... But he won't be, I mean, when Charles becomes king, he will be in his mid to late 70s at the youngest. So he won't have he'll be an elderly king, won't he? Be one of the oldest people to become king, if not the oldest, in British history, I would have thought. Has anyone become king at an older age than Charles will?
No, I don't think so.
And the sad thing is Charles will never get a jubilee unless he's incredibly long-lived.
Mm.
Gets and probably
frozen or something.
I worked out that I think it's very unlikely that William will get a jubilee because he's almost 40 now.
I think William's grown into his baldness, hasn't he? Well, I think that's nice.
William has.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose he...
because I never want to say anything against Prince Edward, but he was a terrible bald person. He had that kind of,
yeah, he went wispy.
You know, he went wispy.
Yeah,
and William did as well.
But I think the key thing, Tom, as a man with not a massive head of hair myself, is to just you can't disguise it.
No,
any attempt to disguise.
So William
is
did a bit.
Folly.
He was kind of combing it, and so was Prince Edward.
Yeah,
but when I take over Prince Edward's image, I will encourage him to go for kind of shave it all and look kind of.
He won't.
People, because it'll make him look strong. And people admire strength.
I don't think it will.
It will.
I don't think
it.
Prince
it will.
Edward. I don't think it will. So I did a pub quiz the other day with a Restless History member called Chris Floyd, who's a photographer. And we went up to Hook Norton to do this pub quiz. And it turned out that it was a very royal-themed pub quiz. And actually,
was
one
it?
Of
was
the,
it a right royal jubilee?
It was. And
God bless
we,
you, Mom.
Where we fell down was our knowledge of Prince Edward. We didn't even know how many children.
Oh, well.
We didn't even know. How many children does he have, Tom?
Three.
No. I think he's got two. He's got two. We thought he had one.
Well, that was wish fulfillment on my part.
Do you know the names of any of Prince Edward's heirs?
Athelstan?
No. No. You see, Prince Edward is a mystery. And from your point of view as the putative spin doctor, that's a good thing. Because you can make him a canvas on which the British people project their desires.
What are the name of his children?
I can't remember.
Well, that's a ridiculous thing to ask then.
But that's the point.
I'm going to check in the Bodleian.
The point. We also had to identify his house, and we couldn't do that. Do you know the name of his ancestral seat?
Wessex Towers.
No, I don't know. I still don't remember what it is. Are you looking it up right now?
This is the kind of details of my hero that I need to know. I realize I know nothing about him at all. Lady Louise Mountbatten Windsor.
Oh, actually, I'm totally
James Mountbatten Windsor.
He does have three children. You were right.
Yeah. No, he doesn't.
Yeah.
He has two.
No. Oh, no, they're two. I thought two. One of them was two. He's got so many names that I thought he was
Louise.
Two people.
See, I like Louise.
Louise Mountbatten Windsor and James Mountbatten.
Princess Louise. Louise the First.
So she would be queen.
So if Charles and William get toppled, as I plan for them to be, and Edward becomes king, I hope he has a long and happy reign. But I think it would be good for the country if he cedes the crown to Queen Louise.
Do you think so? At an early age?
At quite an early age. I just have a feeling, I don't know anything about her, but I have a feeling that she will be a great queen.
Prince Edward and I have something in common. We both studied history at Jesus College, Cambridge.
Well, there you go. How can you not be one of his bannermen?
If things had worked out slightly differently, Tom, you might be doing this podcast with Prince Edward.
Oh, in my dreams.
And he's a man with great theatrical experience. He'd love all your impersonations and stuff.
He could get his
mate Andrew Lloyd Webber, for whom he made the tea famously. Andrew Lloyd Webber could have done the theme tune for the rest of his history. Be like the Phantom of the Opera.
So many what ifs.
Yeah.
Okay, so Sergeant Musgrave.
Right, now I thought we'd get into the...
Sergeant Musgrave is clearly a dangerous communist.
Yeah.
Outraged by the volume of elitist orgia sprayed around by this episode.
Were you spraying orgia?
I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, given Tom and Dominic are obviously establishment cat's paws, but there was no exploration of the role of the Queen in legitimising the class structure, ossifying political debate, and justifying ongoing economic inequality.
So Sergeant Musgrave is obviously the kind of a sort of alternative Marvel alternative universe version of Capel Loft, isn't he?
Yes.
On the sort of dark side. And I engaged with him on Twitter and I said, I don't think the Queen does any of that. And I think...
It's the Tom Nairner argument, isn't it?
It is exactly that. And my evidence for that, which we talked about in our bonus, was that I just think, you know, you look at the Scandinavian royals or the Belgian or Dutch royal family, do they legitimize inequality? I mean, those are some of the most equal, obviously egalitarian societies in the Western world.
I mean, the Danish one is a kind of continuous one.
Yeah.
But the Norwegian one was kind of from scratch, wasn't it? I mean, it was kind of modeled on British.
They got a kind of German princeling or something, didn't they, who behaved... And the Norwegian royals behaved very well in the Second World War.
As did the Danish.
Yeah.
As, of course, did the British.
Yeah, exactly, to be fair.
Yeah, I've always had a slight soft spot for the Tom Nairn thesis. And I think we talked about it
we did a little bit.
The bonus. His great phrase that the royal family are the gold filling in a mouthful of rotting gums.
But you know who would agree with you?
Description of the British state.
Your friend Peter Hitchens.
Well, in that case, but I did kind of. The thing is, I think that every state has to have a legitimizing structure. Otherwise, I mean, even the Soviet Union did.
Yeah.
If every state has to have a kind of myth and has to have a focus, has to have a kind of head of state or something that embodies or symbolizes the state structure, because otherwise it will just, you don't have a state.
Yeah.
And since states inevitably and inherently have structures of privilege, you know, Soviet Union obviously did, China does. I think it's kind of inevitable that the head of state comes to fulfill that role. And I think there is absolutely a case for saying that constitutional monarchy is as effective a way actually as possible of neutralizing that, paradoxical though it may seem.
Yeah, I think that's actually pretty reasonable.
No, because it kind of give, you know, it gives you all the coaches and the flummery and the tiaras.
Yeah.
And then it says, actually, this is not something that other people can have. So in a way, it kind of neutralizes it.
Well, I think what it does is it, I mean, the British monarchy, I made this point to Sergeant Musgrave on the Discord. I think the British monarchy, I mean, he argued the British monarchy sort of upholds conservatism and does all that kind of thing. But you could argue the British monarchy had basically legitimized socialism or social democracy, you know, multiple times in the 1920s when George V was very welcoming to the Labour Party, in the 1940s, ditto George VI and Attlee. In the 1960s, Harold Wilson, I mean, famously the Queen's favourite prime minister, the prime minister she probably got on best with. The monarchy has never stood in the way of social reform or any of
so
those
things. I think that you could absolutely make this case of the British monarchy in the first half of the 20th century, where I think it did stand at the apex of a system of privilege that included the aristocracy. Mm-hmm. But I think that essentially has gone. I think for as long as debs were being introduced and all that kind of stuff,
yeah,
I think that it did serve to affirm that. But I don't think it does anymore.
The other thing is, I think if you look at, so the countries with presidents, I mean, there are two models of presidencies. There's the sort of monarchical presidency that you have in the United States or you have in France. I mean, those societies are not obviously more, you know, less ossified, more progressive, all of those things than Britain is. And then the other is where you basically have the president is a bit of a nobody, like you have in Germany.
Or Ireland.
Yeah. And again, you know, you might say, oh, well, isn't it wonderful in Ireland? They have a poet prime minister and all this, a poet president rather, and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, the British, I'm not saying Britain is better than Ireland or Ireland is anything like that, but Britain's welfare state is more generous than Ireland's. Britain has a universal healthcare and the Irish healthcare system is not as generous as Britain's. So I don't think that the argument that an elected president equals automatic social democracy really stands up. And not least because, let's say we did have an elected president in Britain, who would it be? I mean, would it always be the sort of the darling of the sort of the Guardian comment pages? Or is it equally plausible that it would either be somebody utterly ridiculous, you know, be Alan Sugar, or that it would be actually somebody from the right? That it would be, who's to say Nigel Farage would never have been elected?
Do you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again. The best reason for keeping the royal family is I really like the idea of a head of state who is descended from Woden.
Yeah, well, you're on record saying that.
Yeah. And if that makes me an establishment cat's paw.
A cat's paw and spraying
so
hors d'oeuvre. Yeah.
So
all right. This is a very long bonus episode. Let's finish up by talking about Australian prime ministers. So we got some very nice reactions to this. We got lots of reactions from Australians saying, I can't believe you didn't talk about X or Y.
Yeah. Well, Scott Morrison having a poo in McDonald's.
Apparently this is not true.
No.
So it's very amusing.
So we didn't know whether that was true. So that's why we left it out.
Yeah. Apparently he soiled himself at McDonald's about some kind of rugby result, Australian rules
like
result or something like this. Now let's, so Katrin, I don't know if it's really is Katrin Rogers or is Karen Rogers, and it's a misprint on the piece of paper we've got, but it's shocked as an Australian to hear Australian politics summarized in episode one as stable and sane. A history of constitutional crisis and leadership spills makes it feel otherwise, but maybe this speaks more to the instability and insanity of British politics by comparison. What I would say to that is there's always a difference in politics between the headline, sort of the surface froth, if you like, which is obviously a lot of ludicrous people and leadership spills, but also the underlying stuff, which is the stuff that we don't really talk about in any of
these episodes. The long durée.
Yeah, and French politics or German or Australian, which always, beneath the surface, there's much more continuity and there's much more sort of seriousness than we probably give credit for in our very Suetonius style episodes, don't you think, Tom? And I think I think when you're talking about that, Australian politics actually is, not to say there aren't disagreements or things that I think Australians get wrong, but I think it is generally pretty admirable. What do you think?
One of the things that really struck me was, of course, the big event, the big kind of seismic event in Australian political history is the Gough Whitlam, the ending of the Gough Whitlam's government. And I think it's really striking in that he and Bob Hawke did not kind of raise the country against it.
Yeah.
You know, they were sensitive to the fact that if they objected too strongly, it might create fissures within Australia that might prove very hard to heal. And you can see the kind of the wound that it left was pretty deep because people still talk about it and remember it a great deal. Mm. But if it had become even more polarized and even more toxic, then the damage might have been, you know, much greater. And Whitlam and Hawke did not follow that path. And I think that's kind of admirable.
Yeah.
Sense of patriotism and concern for the country as a whole.
Are there two interesting counterexamples to that? So one of them from the same country, so not from Australia. So one of them is Al Gore, 2000.
Yeah.
Backing down and not pushing. I mean, I think personally, as an outsider, now some of our American listeners will disagree. I think personally, Al Gore won that election, but he knew it would be too difficult and too, you know, they're all, I mean, we can argue about, there is actually in some ways no true answer about who won that election, but he out of exactly the same spirit, he didn't push it, he backed down. And then the other example from the same country is Mr. Trump.
Trump, yeah.
And I think it's that Australian politics, I think, has a very, very incredibly healthy sense of partisan debate, but they don't seem to have it, to have pushed it to the degree, to the all-consuming, absolutist, moralistic degree that certainly Americans have.
I think also that the comment about the impressiveness of Australia as a kind of political culture is also a reflection of how it's gone from being, you know, run from the Colonial Office in London in 1900 to now being one of the wealthiest, most stable, most attractive countries in the world. And I just think that, you know, that if you live in Australia, perhaps you're blind to that, the scale of that achievement. I mean, I have to say, my experience of Australians at cricket matches is that they never knowingly undersell their country. But perhaps deep in their heart, they are.
One thing we didn't talk about, which, I mean, obviously it wasn't really at the forefront of our minds until the awful scenes in Texas. Jamie DG87 said, I'm surprised you didn't mention John Howard's gun laws reforms after the Port Arthur massacre. He wasn't all bad. And a lot of people have been talking about this.
Yeah, they
doubt that, that a right wing, you know, in some ways, some people might say very right wing prime minister passed sweeping, decisive gun laws after the Port Arthur massacre in Tasmania, which completely changed the sort of Australian gun culture and meant that there haven't been repeats.
But I think that reflects the fact that political cultures are different in different countries and that, you know, Australia's right-wing political culture is actually quite different to America's.
And indeed, so Britain's the same. Well, we passed sweeping gun laws after Dunblane.
Yes, we did. Yeah, we did. But obviously, there's definitely a sense in among conservatives in Britain over the past decade or so that Australia absolutely has lessons to teach them. So Lyndon Crosby is, you know, Australian figure who's kind of Svengali for Boris Johnson, which is why the defenestration of Scott Morrison has been greeted with such interest and enthusiasm in Britain by people who want to see Boris Johnson go.
I think it's interesting, and it suggests that Australia and Britain are much more similar than either of them are to the United States. And I think that's absolutely true. The big difference is that although we did talk about, you know, how religion and sort of confessional differences really mattered in Australian politics, Australia is obviously a much less overtly religious society than America is, and more similar to Britain in that regard. So actually, it's much harder, I think, for British conservative politicians, let's say, to import ideas and stratagems from the US because they just don't work in Britain.
Well, America, United States is an old country. I mean, you know, we think of it as the new world, but it is an old country and its traditions are old and its laws are old and its assumptions are old. And a lot of those are of which the right to bear arms is the most obvious and you know, sensitive at the moment. Is Australia hasn't really had time to pick these, to develop these kind of.
Yeah. It's all, Tomiwa Owolade, who appeared on our show talking about African decolonization, wrote an excellent column about a week ago talking about the how infuriating he finds the insistence on seeing British issues through an American lens. And he gave the example of race, obviously. And
was that for Unheard, UNHERD?
Was it for Unheard? I can't remember if it actually genuinely was for Unheard, or you've just given them a free advert for nothing.
I have. I've given them a free advert for nothing. It wasn't Unheard.
But it was all about the sort of post-George Floyd moment. And he was talking about how people in Britain were...
Don't shoot me.
Shane, don't shoot the police. But the police don't shoot, tend to shoot black people in prison, so it didn't work. Or there was even examples, some branch of the NHS did this. They put on their website how they were very keen to, you know, help BIPOC people, which is something like black indigenous people of colour or something like that. And the indigenous people in Britain. I love this.
Well, so the only people who use the word indigenous in Britain are kind of the far right.
Yeah. Talking about themselves.
They're talking about Anglo-Saxons.
Yeah. Or the Celts or something.
Well, generally Anglo-Saxons, I think.
Right.
He also wrote, and Tom also wrote actually a very good essay on in the Evening Standard about the Queen and why he loves the Queen.
What did he say? He loves the Queen.
It was about the Queen going to and dancing with Nkrumah.
Which we very talked about on live stream, didn't we?
Yeah, but I recommend that as well.
So is Tom Owolade a big fan of the Queen?
He said he's not a massive royalist. It's not like he's, you know, it makes his heart beat, but he admires the Queen and looks on her as a kind of granny figure.
That's nice.
And, you know, he's all in favour of it, basically.
There's still part of me, Tom, that would like to see the House of Cromwell restored.
Yeah, I know you would. I know. But as a monarchy.
Yeah. As a hereditary... A bit like, you know how...
the Doge or something.
Yeah, a little bit like... I mean, this is a bad example because, of course, he ended up in bed with the Nazis. But after the Hungary, the Kingdom of Hungary, after the First World War, Admiral Horthy became regent.
So it's still a monarchy. Demands Admiral Horthy for Britain. Yeah. I can see the headlines.
Well, that's a very... Yeah, some people would say that's a very Daily Mail position. But I would say a hereditary law protectorship, possibly.
Or the way that the Stadtholder...
Yeah, I'd have the trappings of monarchy.
The Stadtholder becomes the royal family.
I'd still have. I'd basically keep up that thing that we saw at the state opening of Parliament, where the crown was brought in on its own special cushion.
Yes,
and had its own coach. I'd have that, but I would probably have a hereditary lord protector, a bit like that. The stewardship of Gondor, Tom, is the parallel.
But then, what if the king returns?
Would you throw yourself onto
a bonfire?
This is the problem. So when the king returned, as we discussed in our, I think it was our 12 Days of Christmas, the king did try to return, the Emperor Karl.
Didn't go down well, did it?
And Admiral Horthy just told him to go away, and he was forced to go away. I think that's what I do, particularly if that king is Prince Harry. If he tries to return. Yeah.
Anyway, listen, do you know, we've been talking, I think, for over an hour now.
I know. And it's just Twitter. It's not even a proper podcast.
Well, it's because it's a Sunday morning. I mean, it feels just like a kind of chat, doesn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's a Sunday morning, but also I know that basically, I'll tell you what's awaiting me. We have a game called The Lord of the Rings, Journeys in Middle Earth. It's an incredibly complicated card game.
Are you playing that with Arthur?
And Catherine is away. So Arthur has arranged the game in the whole of the sitting room. It takes hours to play.
Oh, what fun.
The rule book needs another rule book to explain the rule book.
What fun.
So that's what awaits me.
Are you Sauron?
No.
And is Arthur a hobbit?
No, we are both. So I'll tell you who I am. I'm Gandalf and Boromir.
Oh, that's good.
And
complex. You're going to attack yourself.
He is Beorn as a bear.
Yeah.
And he's Legolas.
Nice.
But Arthur keeps misgendering Legolas. He keeps saying she because of the long hair.
Yeah, well.
He can't get it into his head that Legolas is a... Even though he's read the books and seen the film.
I'm afraid that that's what comes of growing up in the Cotswolds.
Yeah. So he dressed up as Mozambique on Friday, which is nice. We just ended up buying a Mozambique-themed T-shirt with a coat of arms of Mozambique.
Not
nice.
A kind of military uniform.
It's a sort of... Military
uniforms, aren't they?
Their crest is a sort of... It's a cross... It's a sort of Soviet style, but it's not the hammer and sickle. It's a sickle and a machine gun, which nice. Is which I kind of like. Classy. Actually. Yeah, it's classy. So he wore that.
Thread would like that.
And it went down very well. But I thought that was going to be funny. But actually, it turned out all the other kids had got Mozambique T-shirts as well. Okay, so, well, so Sergeant Musgrave would have liked it. But you know what? They sang Rule Britannia at their Jubilee Day, which I heartily approve of.
Well, I suppose Mozambique's in the Commonwealth, isn't it?
It is. So, Mozambique voluntarily joined the Commonwealth. It's one of those countries that wasn't part of the empire, but joined the Commonwealth.
Well, look.
They knew what they were getting into.
You've got to go and...
play Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do?
I'm obviously going to do my book.
Ah, Tom.
I'll tell you what, exactly what I'm going to do. I'm writing about a new chapter in which I write about Josephus. And it will begin with a personal anecdote that Suetonius describes.
Yep.
In his Life of Domitian, where he describes watching a group of tax collectors get hold of an old man and pull down his pants to see if he's circumcised to find out if he's Jewish, because the Jews have to pay a special tax.
Jeez.
So that's what I'm going to be writing about.
That's a pretty punchy opening, isn't it?
It certainly is. Anyway, right. So that's what I'm doing.
Well, I'll let you go and do it. And we've been talking far too long on this. I mean, I can't believe we've been whittering so long. Right. We'll see you all. We've got a podcast coming up about, we've got pigeons looming, haven't we, Tom?
We have got pigeons looming. So we've got, you will have had Jubilees. So that will come out on Monday.
Oh, yeah.
And I think tomorrow, so Thursday, is, I think, midwifery.
Is it midwifery?
I think it's midwifery. I know that Jack is there. Maybe he's fallen asleep. We've been talking so long.
Yeah. I think it's my
yeah, it is midwifery. So it's midwifery.
And childbirth. Yeah, childbirth.
And childbirth.
Early then, modern childbirth. Quite a niche.
And then the following Monday, it's Robin Hood.
Yeah, that's a good one. Robin Hood was a very
Robin
good
Hood
one.
Riding through the Glen.
And we should be recording Cleopatra soon.
Yep. So Cleopatra and pigeons.
Because
coming.
When
and
you
then the American
to this,
Civil War, right?
The children's book of the year has just come out, which is my book about Cleopatra, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, the Battle of Actium, all of that. Tom is going to love it.
Top ancient historian.
And when we do our podcast, I think Tom, if we're very lucky, is going to sing excerpts from his...
Oh, from my opera.
From your opera. I want to call it a musical, but that's not right. It's an opera.
It is absolutely an opera. Yeah,
excellent.
I'll do that.
All right, we've got all that to look forward to. We're going to go and enjoy our Sundays. Goodbye.
Goodbye.